Welcome to the sixth in this series of Darwin College lectures on the theme of Darwin. They say that travel broadens the mind, although I suspect that tonight's speaker, having crossed many time zones in the last few hours, wouldn't agree with that. But it's a fact that a number of commentators in the lectures so far have said about Darwin and about Wallace, that travel was crucial to the development of their thought. And when you think about it, of course, since the environment is so crucial to the development of a species and the environment is spatially constrained, you could say that evolution is very much shaped by geography, which is why we were keen to get tonight's speaker, because we wanted someone involved in at the cutting edge of what I think is called biogeography. And in his case, it's molecular biogeography. And he's Craig Moritz, who's at the University of California, Berkeley. He's professor of integrative biology there. He's the director of the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology. Before that, he was at Queensland, and before that at Michigan and ANU and probably other places too. But he's now based with a large research group at Berkeley, and they're concerned with the molecular analysis of issues related to ecology and evolution, how species develop, how their populations change in the face of environmental change. His publication list reveals that he has in the past had intimate relationships with frogs, toads, newts, skinks, crabs, and all manner of things you wouldn't want to meet in a rainforest on a dark night. It's a delight to introduce Craig Moritz to talk about evolution and conservation biology. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to the Master and the other fellows of the college for the invitation. I should start with a clarification. The intimate relationships were purely intellectual. Okay, so it really is a terrific honour for any evolutionary biologist to be invited to Darwin College to speak, and particularly in this year, where we're celebrating both the bicentennial of his birth and the sesquicentennial of the publication of The Origin. It's a very special year for evolutionary biologists, and we hope the public in general, in understanding how Darwin's ideas and his contemporaries, Huxley, Wallace, Lyell, influence in a very deep way the way we think about and appreciate natural systems. No doubt you've heard this from previous speakers, but Dobzhansky coined the quote, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." And that remains very, very true. It's the guiding principle, it's very deeply embedded in the way we approach and think about systems. And I have an admission to make. I've always had The Origin of Species on my shelf. I read it this Christmas. So I'm going to Darwin College. God, someone's going to ask me about Darwin. So I read this book, and it's just brilliant, both as a literary masterpiece and the insights. There were things in there that now large groups of scientists with mega-million-dollar research grants are trying to establish and prove and document. And Darwin just says, well, of course, this obtains. This is how the world works. Absolutely astonishing. So tonight I want to focus not on the whole breadth of Darwin's thinking and his influence, but very specifically on how his ideas and those of Wallace in particular shape the way we think about the effect of environmental change on biological systems, and how that might lead us to better predictions of biodiversity pattern, how species and genes and genetic diversity is distributed across the globe, and how that might influence the way we go about protecting biodiversity in the face of global change. So I want to start, of course, as most people would, with a quote from Darwin. It's not the typical one about this grandeur and this view of life and all that, which is a beautiful phrase as well. But when I was reading, I was hit by this, which I think is just true poetry. And I'm going to read it. And he's talking specifically about... I have technology. Here it is. He's talking specifically about this, the only figure in the Origin of the Species, to which he devotes many, many pages of explanation. This is really at the core of his ideas about how descent with modification gives rise to discontinuities of traits, of characteristics of organisms through evolution, divergent evolution over time, to give rise to things that we call species and higher taxa, genera, families, and so on. But in the middle of this explanation of this, he had this statement, as buds give rise by growth to fresh buds, and these, if vigorous, branch out and overtop on all sides, many a feebler branch. So by generations, I believe it has been with the great tree of life, which fills with its dead and broken branches the crust of the earth. That's the paleontologist. Darwin was a geologist, primarily by training, not a biologist. And covers the surface with its ever-branching and beautiful ramifications. Our job as conservation biologists is to maintain this beauty, these ramifications, in as full a way as we can. So we still have it at the sort of core of our being, if you like, as biogeographers, the insights from Darwin and Wallace. But now we are in the 21st century, and the science has become much richer, particularly in the last decade or so, in ways I'll describe in a minute. But at least from a personal perspective, these are, I think, the core aims and challenges that we have as biogeographers. The broad question is to understand the evolutionary responses, how evolution, that is the processes of adaptation, speciation, extinction, play out in response to past environmental change over long periods and relatively short periods. And then I think a core challenge to us is to be able to predict biodiversity distribution and responses to future environmental change, because it's coming on at us very fast. And if we can achieve these goals, then I think we're in a much better situation to be able to identify the evolutionary processes as they play across landscapes and protect those processes themselves as well as the products. That is to protect the capacity to regenerate diversity after us humans are done clobbering it. Sorry, I may every now and then launch into Australian idiom. I was there just a couple of weeks ago and I got infected again. Fortunately, a lot of us derive from Cockney, so most of you should get it. So where are we now? We still have this broad body of evolutionary theory which started with Darwin and has been extended through the Neo-Darwinian synthesis when the population geneticists and the mathematicians took hold of it and established the link between descent with modification and inheritance, then the structure of DNA and so on. But we now have a very strong body of mathematical evolutionary theory that makes strong predictions about relative roles of selection and random processes, so-called genetic drift, migration, the exchange of genes between populations. We now understand in a fairly deep way how these different major processes interact to promote divergence or retard it through time. What the real revolution at the moment is coming from the sources of data that are available. One of my other jobs is to run the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology, and I've been thinking a lot about how, and as have others, like Michael Ackham here with your museum, how can we grab hold of these new technologies? So we have our tradition, which is collection of specimens, and we still do that. The core of the museum business is to document the distribution of species and the identity of species through a specimen. And that contains information on the traits of species, their body form, their numbers of scales, their color, and so on. But now the big growth areas are genomics and environmental data. So this stuff is pouring out of the satellites, remote sensing, climate surfaces, past, future, and so on. And then genomics ultimately should help us link the phenotype in the specimens to the genetics and therefore to the evolutionary response to environmental change. And central in this, and I'll show you many examples of this tonight, is the phylogeny. There are large-scale efforts in the UK, in Europe, America, Australia, and other countries to discover the tree of life, going back to Darwin's original diagram, to understand how things are related to each other, how long in the past they shared a common ancestor, and so on. And this, if you like, is the glue that holds all this together. So, you know, we still do our hunting for, there's a little salamander and a bird and some little mammal-y thing. I don't work on mammals, I work on frogs and lizards. So all rats look the same to me, I'm sorry. But aren't these cool? These are reptiles and amphibians. Anyway. And now, of course, we have the DNA revolution, driven by the Human Genome Project. The technologies that are now available to us are truly staggering. At the moment, we still sequence one or two genes or five genes on these weird organisms. Now we can do the whole genome. So a lot of it is going to come down to how do we manage the information? It's biodiversity informatics. And that's a real challenge. But it's going to transform the science. And this bridge to theory is going to be a very dynamic one. Even down to simple questions of what is a species. Okay. So what I'm going to do is sort of just outline briefly the problem as I see it, and I'll talk specifically about climate change, and then go back and review some of the tests of some of Darwin and Wallace's core ideas that are now possible with molecular data, and show you how essentially most of their suppositions have been verified with new data. And then I'm going to focus in on the tropics for several reasons. I like the tropics. Weather's great. but also, it's just stuffed full of species. And if you're an evolutionary biologist, you want to go somewhere with a lot of diversity, and that's the tropics. So I think most of you are probably familiar with just the press, this famous hockey stick diagram. And it's been, scientists have tried really hard to pull it apart, disprove it. The weight of the evidence is that it's about right. If anything, it's conservative. Our current trajectory is actually on about the worst case scenario, which is not good news. But there is hope if we all act. Anyway, so the point here is that, you know, climate is changing and changing very fast. And later on, I'll say something about that this is nothing new. Climate does change in the past. But what's different now is we're moving into a set of climates that have no analog, at least in the last million years. So over the evolutionary lifespan of a lot of species on the planet, we're moving them into a set of climate conditions that they simply haven't experienced and that their immediate ancestors haven't experienced. We're moving into uncharted territory for biologists. And some of this was put together, sort of the geographic pattern, by a paper by Williams et al. In PNAS a couple of years ago. And they sort of mapped on the surface of the globe areas with, under two different scenarios, one extreme, one conservative, you know, what would the geographic patterns of climate change look like across the landscape? So you have large areas where there's local change. That is, there's shifts from one geographic cell to another in climates, but it's not going outside of the box of the current range of climates. There are totally new types of climates, new combinations of temperature and rainfall that don't exist anywhere on the globe at the moment turning up, particularly the Amazon. That's still poorly understood, exactly how the Amazon is going to play out, and Wallacea here. And then there are areas with disappearing climates, where the climate conditions that are present now simply vanish. We move into a totally new set of conditions. And this really picks out the montane tropics. So the tropical mountains, the Andes, Mesoamerica, the Eastern Arc Mountains, various mountain systems in Borneo and New Guinea and so on. And this is really quite alarming because this is where a large proportion of as yet undiscovered biodiversity probably sits. The tropical mountains, in many cases, where it's at, and they are also possibly the most threatened, even though the amount of climate change will be less in the tropics in terms of the magnitude of temperature change. For reasons I'll describe, it may be sort of hypersensitive to climate change. And that's also where a lot of the diversity is. Okay, so if you're not sufficiently depressed, I used to give this talks like this, and then I'd put the climate change stuff at the end, And people were just going along nice and happy, looking at phylogenies and critters and so forth and slides, and I'd wham them with climate change at the end. Then ask for questions. Of course, you wouldn't get one because everyone just, oh, damn. So this time I put it at the start to try and get the bad news over first and then and get on with the science. So I'm going to talk a lot about climate change, but I'm not a climate change biologist. I'm just an evolutionary biologist interested in biogeography. But just the sorts of studies I've seen coming out of our museum, and there are many others like it, particularly in England with long-term data sets, are revealing really extraordinary patterns of change that we think are attributable, at least in the main, to climate change. So this is a study we did in our museum in Berkeley, going back to sites at which mammals and birds were studied in great detail 100 years ago. And because we had these beautiful classical-type field notes, we could go back to exactly the same places, we had the specimens, we knew exactly what they were catching. And we went back and redid the survey, and we saw a dramatic change. This axis here is the elevational range of species from sea level up to 3,500 meters. So we're going up and over the crest of the Sierra Nevada in California. And this is just species organized by the pattern of change. These are small mammals, little rodents, batty things. And the things in the lowlands are doing fine. In fact, they're expanding their ranges. Green here shows that the species was originally up to whatever it is, about 1,200 species. Now it's up to about 1,700 species, meters, sorry. So green is good. Green is expanding. And here's one, a high elevation species, a little shrew in this case, that's expanded down. That's kind of interesting. When you go up to the high elevation, species were originally restricted to high elevations are contracting their ranges. They're getting pushed up. So we didn't set out here to study effects of climate change, but when we saw the data, we thought, good God, it can't be anything but. Nearly all the cases of change here are upward shifts in ranges, leading to expansion of lowland species, contraction of upland species, some of which, like this one, are endemic, are only found in the High Sierra. And we predict if this goes much further, we'll become extinct in the High Sierra. The average shift in elevation here, observed over 100 years, is 500 meters in elevation. That's a huge change. And the biological communities have all changed, the patterns of associations between species. There's one. Here's another one published just last week in PNAS by some of our group, looking at salamanders in Mesoamerica through Guatemala, Chiapas, Costa Rica, and so on. And these salamanders were discovered in the 60s by David Wake, who's an expert on these things, and they were highly abundant. They could catch dozens in an hour of searching. And they all had very narrow elevational ranges. Going up, this is an example of a volcano in Guatemala, and each of these is a species range replacing each other as you go up the mountain. And these are very old species at a molecular level. So my student, Sean Revito, went back there to do sort of evolutionary studies on these a couple of years ago and couldn't find them. Dave Wake just shook his head and said, students these days, they don't know how to catch a salamander. He went down there, he couldn't find them. I went down there, I couldn't find them. We think there's been a catastrophic decline in these salamanders in the upper cloud forests of Mesoamerica. And again, we didn't set out to do this. This wasn't the purpose of the research. It's just hit us as we get the data. And here's just some numbers of salamanders through time, putting together records from other collectors from their field notes. It looks like the crash happened in the late 70s, early 80s, when there was a real kick up in temperatures in this area. Now, it's not necessarily temperature. In this case, it could be loss of the lowland rainforest, which has been really extensively cleared over the last 4 or 5 decades, influencing local cloud formation patterns. So if you cut down the lowland forest, you lose the transpiration from the plants, the moisture the plants put out, which drives the formation of cloud forests on which these salamanders depend, because they breathe through their skin. They have to stay wet. And the groups of salamanders that are gone are the ones that live on the floor of the forest, not the ones that sit in the bromeliads. So it looks like it's a drying effect. Anyway, I won't go on. You'll just be too miserable. But the point is that there is already, in these two cases and several really excellent studies on birds and butterflies from Britain and elsewhere, very clear evidence that climate change is profoundly affecting the distribution of species already. Now, with one or two exceptions, of which this is one, we have very few data sets like this for the tropics, because we just don't have the very long-run data such as we were fortunate to have in California in the tropics, but it's urgent to go out and get it. Okay, so we have these profound global-scale changes in the environment occurring now. Temperature, spread of invasive species, spread of diseases like the chytrid fungus that's affecting amphibians worldwide. What should we do about it? Well, of course, this isn't a new thing that we have to protect natural landscapes. And there's been many, many organizations, governments, through this conservation of biological diversity, NGOs like Conservation International, WWF, and so on, all busy trying to identify their priority areas for raising money and spending money to try and protect natural landscapes around the world. And this is a recent summary from Tom Brooks from CNI, and each of these is a different type of prioritization of regions of the globe for protecting diversity, with often slightly different priorities. So a number of these, they all try and focus on hotspots. That is, a hotspot is an area that has a disproportionately large number of unique species. And most of the data for these come from plants and birds, because they're the only organisms for which we have anything like global knowledge of distributions. And now also some groups of mammals and amphibians as well. So this is Conservation International's hotspots, and these are now directing billions of dollars of raised funds back to the nations so identified to try and increase protected areas. So you can see these, you know, there's a certain few common elements to a lot of these maps. The Atlantic forest I'll talk about later pops up in pretty much all of them. Some focus on wilderness areas like this. Some focus on hotspots, but only those that are in areas that are under, that are really threatened by land clearing and other economic pressures. If you overlay them all, you come up with this, these maps of the world where most of the approaches suggest they need urgent conservation action. So that's good. That is directing a lot of resources at a global scale. But it really doesn't tell you anything about how you should go about protecting those areas at the sort of scale at which governments make decisions within a country. So Brazil is not going to say, well, we're going to protect all of this. They simply can't do it. There's 100 million people living in the Atlantic forest alone. So we need to get smarter. Actually, I'm going to skip over that. It's too complicated. Okay, I won't. So this is just another this is another example where the previous one was just mapping areas that have high species richness, lots and lots of species. Now, you can have high species richness just through having a lot of very widespread species in one place, in which case that hotspot may not be terribly unique. There could be another place that has that same collection of widespread species. But we tend to focus on areas of endemism, areas that have lots of unique species in a small geographic area. That's typically how people are defining hotspots these days. And these maps map something like that. They map the turnover in species. How different is the collection of species in one grid cell, in this case 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers, compared to the next one, compared to the next one. And the green areas here are the areas that come up for birds, mammals, and amphibians as all having really high uniqueness per 100-meter grid cell. So these areas that are packed full of unique things at a very small spatial scale. And again, it's the montane tropics through the Andes and then a few other places. But particularly the Andes, Mesoamerica. This was only done for the Western Hemisphere. So at a global scale now, we're getting these quite good data sets on species distributions. We're still discovering new species. We're not done just describing diversity, but there's enough there to start working with, to start mapping out the diversity. And so far, this is all purely descriptive. It's just getting lists of species. So you get a flora from a country that lists all the species that are present. That's your data. So it's just describing patterns of diversity. And we're getting good results at a global scale. But if you come to a local scale, this is just... The scale... Nah, give up on that.
The scale here is just 20 kilometers over that grid. And each of these is a land unit, a farm. That's actually the scale at which decisions finally are made. And when you come down to this smaller spatial scale, except for Britain, which is really amazing, the data here for birds and butterflies and so on, in most parts of the world, particularly the species-rich tropics, we don't know what's in all these cells. We have to predict it. We might have data on a few birds here, someone's seen some butterflies there, someone did a plant count down here. Maybe we know everything about this spot because it's a national park and people have done surveys. But how do you then fill in the gaps? You can only do it by prediction rather than description of diversity. And that, I think, is the big challenge to biogeographers, to turn our science on its head from being descriptive to being predictive and able to predict the pattern of diversity, of uniqueness across these areas. And perhaps more importantly, to understand the processes that generate that diversity. Now, people are zooming in on these hotspots now and trying to get more information. And this slide illustrates two different approaches for Madagascar, which no matter what global prioritization you look at, Madagascar leaps out as an incredibly biologically unique area in many, many groups of organisms. And it's also an extremely poor country, a country with a lot of development challenges, but it's got a fairly far-sighted president at the moment who wants to double the national park area, both for biodiversity itself, but also to protect ecosystem services, clean water, and so on for the residents of Madagascar. So here's sort of two approaches to discovering diversity in Madagascar. One is led by Claire Kremen last year, and it was sort of a brute-forced approach. They took all the distribution data they could get for nearly 2,500 species, covering a wide range of groups of types of organisms. So ants, lemurs, frogs, geckos, butterflies, plants, and then try and using various methods to try and estimate what the real range of those organisms is, mapping it out, and then identifying what are the most unique areas for conservation in Madagascar. And they could look at areas that already have national parks, so the yellow areas, the new areas coming in already, the blue areas, and the red areas are the areas that they said should be added to maximize the capture, if you like, of these unique species across the landscape. So that was a really huge scale effort. It took years to do, a little cooperation from hundreds of scientists. And it's still very incomplete. There's a group I interact with who are studying the frogs of Madagascar, nearly all of which occur only in Madagascar. And they gave me the first edition of their book, which was about an inch thick, about 5 years ago. They marched into my office the other day with a new edition of the book, which is about 3 inches thick. Now, it's not just heavier paper. They've trebled the number of known frogs in Madagascar in the last 5 years, particularly using DNA sequencing methods as well as traditional systematics. And they reckon they're about halfway there. So next time, it's going to be a telephone book. Right? But the challenge just of describing this diversity is it's exciting to a systematist, people who just love finding new things, but it's challenging if you need to make decisions now. Madagascar, they've got one more year to refine this process, then the president's going to act and declare the national parks. They're not going to know all the frogs by then, let alone the ants and the millipedes and what have you. So this is another approach, which again is working just with one group. It's got about 30-odd species of this particular subfamily of frogs in Madagascar. And they asked, using a combination of the species ranges and the phylogenies, the patterns of relationships among these, what are the landscape features of Madagascar that tend to promote lots of species or rapid speciation and divergence? So the red cells here are the areas with the most frogs per cell, right, red down to pink and then white, as this is very dry out here, based on the available survey data. And then these are the areas that have the most narrow range species, species that have the smallest geographic ranges. And and in many cases, these are fairly recently evolved species. And they found there was a strong correlation with how complex the topography is, how steep the mountains are, how complicated the landscape is, and the number of narrow range species. And after the fact, that sort of makes sense, that speciation could occur, a la Darwin, through divergent selection, isolation, and mountains are where these processes play out on a very small spatial scale. So you'll end up with a lot of very narrowly defined species. So this is starting to get rather than at, and I have tremendous admiration for this work, but it's descriptive and it's very hard. Can we go from description to prediction? And thereby sort of try and get ahead of our incomplete knowledge. Here's another example of a study of a hotspot, and again illustrating the use of phylogenies. This is the Western Ghats, so the Western mountain chain in India, coming down to Sri Lanka. And for a long time, these have been treated as a single hotspot, a single area of focus for Conservation International and so on to put their resources into. And it's been assumed that they were pretty much the same thing, because although this is now an island, of course, it's very shallow across this strait, and it was all connected when sea level was lower. So it's been assumed it's just one thing, and if you put a bunch of money here, that's probably sufficient to protect most of the diversity in the whole system. Well, no. This group, Frank Bossart and others, studied the phylogeny. Each of these is a phylogeny. So for those of you who aren't familiar with these little tiny diagrams, of course, don't try and read the labels, the usual thing. The closer things are together is a molecular phylogeny. So they sequence a bunch of genes, the same set of genes from all these different species, and then connect them according to who's closest, to make a long story short. So these are all undescribed species, these three, but they're all very closely related to each other. And then their nearest relative is this clade or group of species here, and so on up and down the chain. The green ones are the ones from Sri Lanka. The brown ones are the ones from India. So you can see the green ones, in most cases, are all clustered together and different from the brown ones. That is that the Sri Lankan fauna has a separate evolutionary history to the Western Ghats fauna. They're not the same thing.
Right. And that becomes really clear.
And if you saw it in just one group, you'd say, ah, it's something about that group.
But here's various types of amphibians and reptiles and fish, a little crayfishy thing, a crab. It's very strong
in the species that live in the mountain rainforests of these things, that they've had quite separate evolutionary histories. So again, another very simple insight that can come out of this sort of comparative study of relationships using molecular techniques. So that's all by way of sort of building the case that evolutionary biogeography or historical biogeography has something very important to offer international bodies, and as well as national bodies, that are trying to improve on biodiversity conservation. And these are some of the things that we hope it can do. Reveal the processes, not just the pattern, but the underlying evolutionary processes that generate and maintain diversity, and thereby develop an improved prediction of biodiversity pattern given incomplete knowledge. And then I'll spend a bit of time now talking about how insights into how rainforest faunas have responded to past climate change might help us understand sensitivity to future climate change. So it's important to, in politics, it's important to understand history, to understand what the effects of current policies might be in the future. Now, a lot of politicians don't get that, but it's still true. It's the same in biology. If you understand the history and the processes, you're better placed to make a prediction about the future. So I think both of these elements will increase the effectiveness of conservation planning. So let me take a segue now back into Darwin and Wallace and just look at how some of their key observations and suppositions have really been reinforced with these new molecular tools. Often when I'm wandering around the rainforest looking at some of the same sort of things that Wallace or Darwin would have looked at, I wonder what they would have done with a Gilson or an automatic sequencer. The sort of technology we have now, I bet they would have hated email. So what were some of the key insights, and this is well known to many people in this room, but it's still useful to go through. Actually, I'll start with the Sarawak Law, which was before The Origin of the Species, written by Wallace while he was, I think it was malaria, but I may be wrong, but he was sitting in his tent drenched in sweat in Sarawak, or sitting in Brooks's mansion, more likely.
Every species has come into existence coincident, both in time and space, with a pre-existing closely allied species.
Now, we didn't yet have the idea of natural selection. That came to him later with the Ternati paper in 57. But already he was thinking about genealogies of species being related to each other, having a common ancestor. This alone was a profound observation, which Darwin quotes in the Origin, well, quotes, or at least cites in The Origin of the Species, one of his very few citations. So these incredible men came up with many things, but if I can just pull a few key things out, the set with modification is at the core of it. That is that existing species now have common ancestors in the past from which they've evolved by natural selection. And Darwin thought this applied to both varieties, or what we might now call subspecies, as well as species, and didn't really see a huge difference between these things. A view that's now actually coming back into vogue in some circles. He also promoted gradualism. He wasn't about abrupt change. He was particularly following from his essentially coaching from Lyell and Lyell's influence on gradualism of geological change. Darwin was a gradualist.
He saw that evolution response could occur over very long time periods in response to environmental change. And Darwin really explicitly focused on interactions between species, survival, the struggle for existence, which was Spencer's term, the struggle for existence being the prime driving force of natural selection, interactions of species. He was really interested in what happened if a species moves to a new place and has to interact with a novel assemblage of species is already there, that would really drive rapid evolution. And they both also emphasized isolation, particularly through their studies of islands, where naturally you get less genetic connectivity between islands than you get in a continuous environment. So this biotically driven selection and isolation were two, as they saw it, the key drivers of adaptive change and speciation. And to a large extent, that's where the field is now. It's much more sophisticated now. We have equations, we have DNA, we have much more powerful tests, but that's really where we are. Now, some of the evidence that Darwin used to shore up his argument, his one long argument, was the geographic patterns of distributions, that species, the closely related species, tend to be close together geographically, that members of a genus, the next hierarchical level up, tended to have a geographic focus, and so on. He argued this was really only explicable through descent with modification. And they focused a lot, both of them, on island radiations. Darwin Wallace was in Wallacea, or in the Malay Archipelago, when he wrote his key papers, and subsequently wrote books on this. Darwin devotes a whole chapter to it in The Origin. And it's really about evolutionary radiation from a common colonist, a single species that arrives in a place, and he's thinking here about remote archipelagos, like the Galapagos, a single species arriving and then diversifying through natural selection to occupy that space. So I just want to pick out a couple of examples where recent studies have shed some light on some of these ideas. And again, most of them come from integrated studies of traditional systematics, the study of morphology, variation within and among species, and the DNA. So this is one study from a group of spiders that have managed to colonize and diversify on remote Pacific islands. So Australia's down here, the US is over here, Europe's somewhere over in the gallery there. This group is Rosie Gillespie and Becca Gubb. They've studied the spiders over these islands. They build a phylogeny again, so things that are close together here have very recently diverged. And the key point here is that if you look at the spiders from all these islands, there's essentially one source, all of these things from the Tahiti Society, Tumuru Island, the Marquesas Islands, up to Hawaii, all grouped together phylogenetically. They have a single common ancestor that we can trace back using the molecules. And their closest relatives are over here in Mexico and elsewhere in the North America. So they've come from here and then diversified here. The spiders down on the Austral Islands, down here, although they're very close to here, have their, again, grouped together phylogenetically. They have a single common source. And their ancestors are sitting over here.
So Darwin was, and both Darwin and Wallace are really interested in the idea that the nearest mainland would be the colonist, the single colonist would come from the nearest mainland, occupy these islands, diversify by speciation.
And these are some examples. These ones have likely come from the mainlands over here somewhere, spread through here. These ones have come via a different route. And now these different evolutionary lineages are meeting in French Polynesia.
One more example along the same lines. This is the
Lobeliad radiation in Hawaii. There's
some 126 species only found in Hawaii. They're all endemic to Hawaii.
And Tom Givnish and his group have just published this very beautiful paper in the last couple of weeks. I thought it made a nice example. These Lobeliads have all sorts of different growth forms. They occur in the wet forest. They occur on cliffs and rocky places. They're in coastal scrub and desert in some other places.
And again, using a molecular phylogeny and using that to provide at least approximate dates of when different divergence events occurred,
Givnish's group were able to show that all the Hawaiian group,
which previously was thought they were so different morphologically and ecologically, people thought they couldn't all have come from one thing. There must have been multiple introductions to Hawaii.
Well, no, they all have a common ancestor. And that ancestor, no matter whether you use dating from fossils down here or the beautifully calibrated age of islands in Hawaii, comes to about 13 million years.
And that's actually older than the Hawaiian chain. At least the extant, it's older than the extant islands.
The oldest extant islands, well, French frigate shoals is about 13 million years. Kauai and Maui and so forth are less than 5 million years.
And the same is true of the Drosophila in Hawaii. There are hundreds of species of Drosophila unique to Hawaii, and their common ancestor seems to be about 23 million years ago when the extant islands were right up here at the top of the chain. So these were big islands. That's something else Darwin was really into. These were big islands back then, and they've just been eroded and submerging over time. So the old islands are up here, now underwater, seamounts. Hawaii is the big island. That's the very young one.
So these have diversified from a single ancestor about 13 million years ago. And you can map
the types of characteristics they have back on this phylogeny, this pattern of relationships,
to ask, well, what did the original ancestor look like? And that was a woody species. It was a blue one here, so it was on cliffs and rocky outcrops. You can reconstruct what the ancestors probably looked like through a parsimony argument. And then put together
the sequence of evolution as these
130-odd species developed within Hawaii. And it sort of started with
shifts in habitat, then with elevational zonation, and then in flower length, and so on. So again, these were the sorts of processes that Darwin and Wallace were both fascinated by. I'll skip that. Now, one of the sections of Origin of the Species, in fact, much of it deals with the problems of the theory. So he knew that because it was such a revolutionary idea at the time, the people were really going to try and deconstruct it as quickly as they could. So he focused a lot of attention on areas that he thought were a problem. And one of those was if groups of species all had a common ancestor and therefore should have geographic relationships with each other, what about the species that occupy, say, the southern tips of South Africa, South America, southern parts of Australia? They're related. How do you understand that? Well, he never had an answer for that because he didn't know about continental drift and Gondwana. We now know that. Right? So again, he couldn't figure that out, but with new science, we have the explanation for the pattern that he just said, I don't get it. It's too hard. And Hooker couldn't get it. Another thing that puzzled him was temperate clades like the lupines. Beautiful flowers that occupy high elevation, temperate environments in North America, Asia, and South America. If they're all related, how on earth did they get to be related and yet have distributions that are isolated by the Bering Strait and the tropics? Well, the Bering Strait is easy. It was a land bridge these cool adaptive things could move across it when it's a land bridge. And Darwin at the time was fascinated by glaciation. That was another sort of mid to late Victorian, really rapidly developing field of science, was understanding Earth history with respect to glaciations.
So his argument was, well, when it was glacial in the tropics, it was a lot cooler, and at that point, temperate lineages could jump the tropics.
They could move through it, displacing tropical species as they went, and then colonize areas to the south. A grand idea, a great hypothesis. He had no way of testing it.
With molecular data, we now can, and look at this for the lupines. Here's the, just from this B group down, here's the North American species in the phylogeny, here's the Mexican ones, and here's the Andean species. Right? They're all incredibly close related. They've just jumped across the tropics, moved down, diversified incredibly fast, exactly as Darwin suggested. Now, it's a bit earlier. It's back in the early Pleistocene rather than the last glacial maximum, which is what Darwin was talking about. But the basic idea was correct. Quite brilliant. I wish I had ideas that would last this long.
One last one is Wallace. And some of his earliest work, and of course he lost all these specimens with a shipwreck on his way back from his first voyage to the Amazon.
But he was fascinated by the effect of rivers, and he spent a lot of time in the Rio Negro up here. And he noticed that the
primate species in particular had different forms on opposite sides of the river. And his idea about isolation as a really important factor in promoting divergence came in part from those observations. So recently people have gone back. Actually, not much of this has been done, which is surprising to me. But
this is one study on the saddleback tamarin, really beautiful little primate. The described morphological forms are all separated by rivers.
So are rivers, in fact, the isolating barrier?
Well, Carlos Perez and Jim Patton and others went back and studied in great detail just one river, the Jiru, which is, I think, this one down here, and studied both the genetics and the morphology and found across the main sections of the river,
where the river's very wide, there are indeed different forms on either side, and they're genetically really different to each other. They're long isolated by the river, and they sampled right up to the river. But when you go to the headwaters,
and I should add, Jim Patton sank two boats doing this work.
So sinking boats is actually a common theme among biogeographers.
When you get up to the headwaters, suddenly you get this interaction. You get this blurring of the boundary between the species and indeed the genes.
So, and again, this was Wallace's intuition,
that the main branches of the river, the downstream section, would be barriers, but as you went further up,
there'd be the opportunity for genetic exchange up at the headwaters. And this has been verified. Okay. Ooh, look at that. So, you know, just in my own little area of science, the more we study, the more we're refining. There's very few of Darwin's major ideas, other than inheritance, how inheritance works, that have been radically overturned. We're just embellishing, adding more weight of evidence to this grand theory as we go along. So I want to come back now to historical biogeography and really focus in on the tropics and ask what we've learnt by studying tropical systems using this combination of approaches that might help us understand the effect of future climate change. So let me start with the notion of a predictive model. Much of biogeography in the past has been trying to understand how individual lineages of organisms have responded to past climate change, just trying to figure out what happened. We haven't yet done a very good job of turning it on its head and trying to develop some general principles that we could then turn to lesser known groups and predict the spatial pattern of diversity. So moving from studying individual lineages to studying landscapes and asking how do particular landscape features promote diversity or not, and drive evolution. Now, again, it's not an entirely new way of thinking about it.
MacArthur and Wilson, two really eminent ecologists and a systematist,
came up with a beautiful model of how diversity might accumulate on islands as a balance between extinction and speciation called the equilibrium island model of biogeography some decades ago. And they focus on processes of immigration, that as new species coming from the mainland to colonize the island.
And species extinction, which was largely in their construction, effective area.
So small islands can sustain less species because there aren't as many resources or as much diversity of habitats.
And the closer you are to the mainland, the more opportunity you have for species to colonize.
Now, there isn't actually any speciation in this model. It's just species coming from somewhere else and surviving or not. But it was still way ahead of time. It was a predictive model.
And it makes a number of predictions that are heavily used in conservation biology still, although sometimes criticized, about big is better than small. So big reserves will maintain more species. And it's also clear, and was noted on even by Darwin and Wallace, that more remote islands will tend to have fewer species than islands closer to the continent.
But this actually just describes species richness, not endemism.
So this is a horribly complicated slide,
because I'm not as clever as MacArthur and Wilson. But I think it's sort of where we've come to in trying to think about what are the processes that might operate across landscapes that both generate diversity in the blue box and retain it over long periods.
So processes that generate diversity are adaptation,
a la Darwin.
That's really clear. And in particular, Darwin focused on biotic interaction, but there's also a good deal of evidence now that adaptation to alternative physical environments, different soil types, different rainfall types, will also drive diversification,
will provide the template, if you like, for natural selection.
So these are processes that will generate diversity. There's also a good deal of argument back and forth about whether just random processes, just random stochastic changes in genes and distributions of genes can drive speciation, and indeed it can, but both in the lab and inferred from the historical record, but it's an exceptionally slow process. So in terms of things that drive rapid diversification, divergent natural selection is the big game in town. So these are, if you like, the generative processes, and then the opportunity for
The objects of those processes to survive depends on, can they find a place to live? Is there vacant niche space in the
jargon? In other words, is there a unique
set of resources that they can use, or ways in which they can use the resources?
Genetic isolation, this is, again, a theme of Darwin and Wallace.
The more isolated you are from the homogenizing effects of genetic exchange, the better able you are to evolve unique forms.
And then stability is to be very important for a gradual process like genetic drift, which, by the way, Darwin explicitly excludes. He says, really, this is the only thing that's really going to work. But the stable environments might enable enough time to build up these sort of differences. And this has really been the focus of a lot of thought and interest recently in trying to develop predictive models for particular landscape types that could give us ways of extrapolating our current knowledge to understand the full pattern of diversity. But the other thing going on, and again it was a theme of Darwin, was the effects of Pleistocene glacial cycles.
He was really interested in this,
and as I'll show in a minute, the current data really support profound effects of that. So they've taken the species
generated over a very long period through these other processes and shuffled them around on the landscape in response to past climate change. This is very clear from the paleontological record and also, as I'll show you,
from genetic data. So, and that's had a profound effect on how the species generated through these processes are now distributed across the globe.
So the science of macroecology, which is sort of looking for ecological explanations of diversity patterns,
in the main has focused on current ecological variables, like how much area is there, like the island biogeography theory. How productive is the landscape? What's the net primary productivity, the amount of energy coming in, photosynthesis, and so on? And also heterogeneity, how variable is the environment? How many different vegetation types are there in an area? And so on. These are all things that we know influence diversity. But there hasn't yet been enough connection between the ecologists and the biogeographers to bring in what Darwin clearly saw, which was the effects
of past climate change on the distribution of organisms. Interestingly, Wallace had a different take. He was very impressed by how stable the tropics are. And his argument for tropical diversity was it's just been there a long time, it's been very stable, things have just built up over time. Particularly later in his life, this was his argument.
Whereas Darwin was arguing that the tropics were profoundly affected by this past climate change
to enable the temperate clades to move across, like I showed you earlier. So now with these wonderful global data sets, there's been some fascinating attempt to try and predict statistically patterns of species diversity and then test it with the observed data across places like Africa or South America. These are both examples of such studies. The red here is the pattern of bird species richness for all species or just the African and sub-Saharan African endemics. And these are the model errors, if you like. So the red spots here indicate, after you put in things like area, heterogeneity, productivity, how much you fail to explain.
So the red spots,
to my mind, are the interesting ones.
That's where the current ecology fails. And a lot of it's the tropical mountains, the Albertine Rift and East African Arc Mountains, Cameroon Mountains, and so on, with a few other spotty places around Africa.
Likewise, in South America,
this is a similar thing, looking at the at how much of the information is explained in the using the current ecology. It's work by Carsten Rabeck and colleagues. And they point out again that it's the tropical mountains,
particularly for species with very small geographic ranges, where we really can't understand the pattern of species diversity just using current ecology. It's got to be something about history. And I and many others think that something is how stable areas have been through climate change. I'm going to skip over that. So climate change, in fact, is nothing new. And we all know that. In fact, a common criticism, I think, of some of the doomsday arguments about future climate change is, well, climate's been changing all the time. We've had Pleistocene cycles. In the millions of years ago, we had a very warm world, an even warmer world.
So this axis here is a proxy for temperature. And, you know, 50 million years ago,
it was really hot.
And then there was this mid-Eocene optimum, the mid-Miocene optimum, 15 million years ago, which is in the life history of a lot of the related groups of organisms we look at now. So it was a much warmer and sometimes wetter world, not always, sometimes wetter world, back here some 15 million years ago. And then as the Northern Hemisphere ice sheets developed in particular, you saw the cooling and drying of the globe, and then the Pleistocene cycle shown here more recently.
So the timescale of existing species is often thought to be somewhere 1 to 10 million years. Somewhere in that range is a rough idea.
So many of these species have experienced this climate change, which will have profoundly affected their ranges. And sometimes that climate change is really fast, just over
a few hundred years, such as the Younger Dryas. But the point is that we're now moving into a climate condition,
which, and you can't even see it on this slide because it's sort of zipping up so fast, it is warmer than anything that's been around for at least the last 1 million years, maybe even the last 2 million years.
So we are, as I said earlier, moving into a new domain. So what's been the effect of these, particularly the recent glacial cycles, on the distribution of diversity? Well, paleontologists have documented species range shifts from the fossil record of beetles and plants, particularly in Europe. And the geneticists have come into the fray to ask, look at patterns of genetic difference. How different are, in this case, a whole suite of plant species from different sampled areas around Europe? And most of the big genetic differences between areas occur in the south, not the north.
The north was all an ice sheet with tundra and permafrost down here.
England wasn't a great place to be.
And whereas in the south, there were all these so-called refugia, areas that retained a lot of these species that are now much more widespread up through Europe.
Now, this is not a complete picture. There's
now good genetic and fossil data emerging for a few other small areas that retained a few species. But the general picture is of what Godfrey Hewitt from East Anglia called southern diversity and sort of northern purity, I think he calls it,
and there was much more homogeneous genetic patterns in the north, with lots of diversity down here along the Mediterranean. And these are just different species showing some different proposed pathways of migration after the ice sheets moved back. Well, in rainforests, people have developed the same argument, that the cold, dry periods of glacial periods, of the glacial cycles, force rainforests back into small areas from which they then expanded again. And that isolation, together with environmental differences between areas and the biotic interactions that were forced by those range changes, could well have driven speciation in the way that Darwin and Wallace envisaged.
And this was particularly Jürgen Hafer's idea in 69, based on birds. This is now very hotly disputed for the Amazon. The black areas are areas that they thought for different groups of organisms had lots of narrow range species. These must have been the refugia. Ooh, I'm nearly out of time.
This is now hotly debated for the Amazon. But in fact, we have good evidence for it in some tropical systems. And I want to take you to Australia now,
just briefly, and the system I've been studying, which is this series of rainforests
in northeastern Australia, which is a tiny little area of forest occurring across mountains. But it's very small, but we know a lot about it in terms of its climate, its past climates, and the distributions of species. And from various modelling methods, we've been able to predict where rainforests would have been under different climate conditions,
and then using GIS to identify areas
that would have been stable throughout all these climate changes. And these are our predicted refugia, this idea that stability retains all these products of evolution, these narrowly endemic species. So using this, we've built maps predicting where the purple spots in particular are the areas that we think retained rainforest, whereas the rainforest down here in the south and out here in the west and in the north were lost in one period of climate change or another in the past.
So if habitats, if you have a large area of habitat now and it contracts in the past back to two separate areas, two different refugia, to these stable areas, then you would expect high diversity in each of these areas and also a lot of uniqueness, so-called local endemism. The species here should be different from the ones there, because it's a different species pool. Whereas if there's just one area of rainforest that then expands, you'll still have high diversity here, but then low diversity here, representing this historical expansion of species after the Ice Age. So the data we have support this notion very strongly for this forest. These are very simple spatial models of how the forest might have responded to past climates. And indeed, just focus on this one. This is species richness on this axis and how stable those areas are over climate change. And you do get more unique species, more rainforest-dependent species in the areas that retain forest, independent of how widespread or the area of those forests. So stability really matters for predicting endemicity. It also matters, this is the same sort of modelling process, in this case for a species,
a snail,
that occurs throughout these forests. We can also look at it
genetically. So we produce the models using GIS, taking the distribution records, asking where should these species occur now, and then where should they have occurred in the past,
produce this map of refuges, and then compare it to the patterns of genetic diversity that we see in populations now. So isolated areas that persisted should be genetically unique, like they are here, separate from this one. This area is recolonized from here. This area with the big refuge has lots more genetic diversity, and so on.
So we now have tools using the molecular methods to validate, or at least critically evaluate, these spatial models. And I'm going to skip a couple of slides here because I spent too long talking here. And I want to jump down to the implications of this for conservation. So we now have a tool that enables us to predict biodiversity pattern, this persistence part of the model I showed you before, and also to understand the pattern we see across the landscape. So this was an exercise where we took all the insects whose distributions we know, and the snails and the plants and the vertebrates, and asked, what are the areas most important for conservation? What are the areas that have as you accumulate areas, capture the most unique species. It's a conservation planning algorithm used by Conservation International and others.
So it picks a big area of rainforest first, and an area in the north, and an area in the south, an area in the north. So we're jumping back and forth across this big biogeographic break that's been there for millions of years.
So this past of isolation and divergent evolution, the process has driven this
biogeographic pattern that now appears when we just do the more descriptive approach of mapping biodiversity values. For reasons I don't have time to go into, we also argue that this area, which is now has lots and lots of hybrid zones where these long isolated faunas have now come back together
and are interacting, in some cases generating new species because of that interaction.
That's very important for conservation too,
because it protects a key evolutionary process. I'll skip, that's what I just said. Coming back to the bad news, essentially what we've done now is to identify these refugia, these long-term stable areas that are protected and built up all this unique diversity in the system. If you look at models of the likely impact of future change on the habitats on these high elevation forests,
what we see is the areas that are predicted to go first are these areas that
persisted through the glacial cycles. Because we're going into a different type of climate. It's going to be hotter, and the rainfall is going to be more seasonal than it has been in the past, if the models are correct.
And even a very now conservative estimate of climate change predicts tremendous loss, over 50% loss of the habitat in these historic refugia
that have concentrated all the endemic species in them, as well as a lot of the unique genetic diversity.
This is another dire, but it just gets worse and worse.
I'm not going to stay on this. This makes me want to cry. These are beautiful places. They're great little frogs and lizards and things I care about deeply. So what we've moved to, I think, is from the studying the system and knowing a lot about its pattern of diversity, combining it with phylogenies, genetic data, these GIS modeling methods, is we're moving now towards a predictive approach of taking it to areas in the world that are less well understood to see if we can influence and improve
conservation efforts there. And this is basically the process. We build these GIS models of modeling the habitat through time of rainforest, particularly montane rainforest. That gives rise to spatially explicit hypotheses, maps of where we think there should be unique diversity or not across that landscape. Then we get the genetic data and the species data, and we have a variety of statistical approaches to test these hypotheses with.
So my last example will be the Atlantic
forest in Brazil, where I was 24 hours ago. And I was just down here catching frogs. It was a heap of fun.
That's what I'm going back to tomorrow.
So this is a model of stability for the Atlantic forest of Brazil.
Now, the Atlantic forest of Brazil is one of the most threatened and least understood biomes of all these hotspots around the world. As I said, there's 100 million people living in the footprint of the Atlantic forest, and there's somewhere between 20 and 5% of it left, depending where you are in Brazil.
So these models predicted this black area through Bahia, Northern Espírito Santo, to Pernambuco,
as being an area that was more stable than the southern part of the forest,
which are down here in Rio and Sao Paulo and further south. So we predicted this area should have
more unique species that retain more of the unique diversity,
whereas the areas in the south should have had, for many species, recolonization from this refuge.
So less spatially unique diversity. It's very simple. And happily, it worked. So my
postdoc went and looked at, did most of this work, Anna Carnival, went and sampled her favorite critters, these pond-breeding frogs that I found only in the forest, looked at their DNA,
thank you.
And again, here's some of these trees of genetic diversity, if you like. And the green areas in each case are the samples from
the refuge area.
And the yellow dots are the samples from
this expansion zone, the area where there's forest now, but we think there wasn't forest throughout all the climate changes.
And in each case, the yellow areas have very low genetic diversity, exactly as we would predict. The closest things are the next populations back in the refuge, and there's lots of variation, maybe even some in these cases some discrete species, new species, undescribed, setting up in these refugial areas.
So we're now working with the Brazilians to go in, and this area is actually very poorly understood because the money in Brazil is mostly in Sao Paulo and Rio. So that's where all the biological survey work has been done. This area in Bahia
is very poorly sampled
for most groups of organisms, yet we predict it has the most diversity. It's also the most threatened. It's less than 5%
of the original forest left, but still good conservation potential
because there's a lot of the cacao plantations on Caprucas could maintain a lot of diversity. So again, it's a very simple approach, but it may have some value for conservation.
So coming back to where we started,
I really hope that we can transform our science of biogeography to go back to the roots of Darwin and Wallace and develop a more predictive science. We've done a great job with these new tools of understanding particular lineages and describing diversity. We now need to understand better how that diversity is shaped by past environmental change if we're going to protect all this ever-branching and beautiful ramifications in the face of future change. Thank you, and I apologize for going a bit long.
Well, isn't it lovely to have Wallace celebrated alongside Darwin for their amazing and powerful theory. One of the things that kept occurring to me as Craig Moritz was talking, how beautifully complimentary his talk was with that of Sean Carroll. Sean Carroll analysing the DNA within us all, of all living things, to explore how we had evolved and what environmental shocks had shaped the species that exist. And Craig Moritz using these fascinating predictive devices of molecular phylogenetics to explore where things were going and how environmental change would impact upon them. To say this is important for life on Earth is an understatement. I think for me the heroes of this talk have been the creepy crawlies. You can see I'm not a zoologist, but things that don't travel far, combined with scientists with amazing patience and tolerance of grubby conditions, have turned in a way into the canaries of the modern world, only whereas canaries told us about the lethality of mines, the creepy crawlies are telling us about the lethality of the planet. Thank you very much for that beautiful talk.